what's coming up, what's going down, what's coming to our town. It's gonna be good, hope it don't flood. Oh, it's what's upstream.
Well, good afternoon, everyone.
Mm-hmm. All right. Good afternoon, Clear Creek County. This is the What's Upstream Show. I'm your host, Mark Cuccinella, here with my co-host, the esteemed Lori Beckel. And we have a special guest today. Hi, Lori, by the way.
Hi, Mark. Hello, everyone out there in K-Goat Radio Land.
Yeah. We have a special guest today. Fire Chief Jeremy Jones is in the house with us. Jeremy, welcome. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you. Thanks for the opportunity.
All right.
Yeah, let's just take a moment to wish everyone a happy Earth Day, Mark.
Yeah.
Because our Earth is in some serious trouble. We're going to be talking about that soon with Chief Jones. And it is a day to really celebrate our Earth and our important care for it. So I just left Carlson School, and they have a full day of teaching those children over there all about taking care of the Earth and science and animals, and it was very inspiring.
Yeah, you know, I think back to the first, I'm old enough to be able to do this, think back to the first Earth Day. Was it 1970? Might have been 71. Mm-hmm. But at any rate, I think back and I remember the sense of hope and optimism that if we just focused our energy on that issue, we could save ourselves from self-imposed destruction, you know, and it's turned out to be a bigger struggle than anyone could have imagined. Maybe, you know, when there's money involved, it's hard to turn people's minds around. Who said? Somebody said one time, some smart person said, it's hard to change a person's mind when their paycheck depends on it, and there's a lot of money in destroying the Earth.
Yeah, but I also think part of the message of Earth Day is really taking responsibility,
sure,
and being accountable, all of us, for our own behavior. And I think we're going to be talking about that some too, because there just aren't enough resources to go around for somebody else to do it.
Yeah.
We must be part of the solution.
Definitely. Thank you, Lori. All right, Jeremy, again, welcome. And the last time we spoke to you, you were assistant chief, and you were in here with Chief Babian, and we had a very deep and instructive conversation, and we know we'll have the same today. So welcome and congratulations to your appointment as chief.
Yeah, thanks. It's been an interesting 4 months. Let's say that.
Yeah. Well, why don't you kick it off, and anything you think that's that you need to talk about to bring us up to date in your tenure?
You know, I think this just so everybody understands that we're continuing to try to figure out solutions to whether it's our wildfire problem within our community, especially with the low snowpack this year, and people are very concerned. And just overall reducing risks, and I say reducing risk is that's our commercial districts within our towns, right? We're heavily dependent upon tax revenue supporting our communities and jobs.
Mm-hmm.
So a major fire in any of our downtown communities is devastating to our community.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're working with property owners and commercial operations to reduce risk there. Property owners, like in Lori's neighborhood, for example, we work also, but all throughout the community, Evergreen side of the county and our side of the county, just to lower the overall risk of fire in the community. And this is an incremental thing. This is not a we're done in 60 days guaranteed thing. This is we're done in 60 years.
Mm-hmm.
And we're 30, 40 years behind on a lot of this stuff. So it's a uphill climb to get caught up. But I think we're making traction. We've got really good community support. We've got really good understanding from business owners all the way down to literally the 19-year-old kid who just graduated high school who's working at Bojo's on weekends understands what the risk is to a certain degree and how he or she can affect that. And I think it's an interesting place to be in this community. It's a great place to live. We all agree that we want to we live here for a reason, and we want to have it look like this, same look as good as it does now in 150 years. And it's going to take all of us collectively. And that's where I think we come in with the fire authority, and whether it's us or Evergreen Fire Protection District or even Timberline Fire, which all work within our within Cricket County essentially to reduce risk and make sure people go home safe every single day.
Thank you for that, Jeremy.
So and, crossing county lines, you're you're talking about.
We do. We cross. I think we cross more than people realize. We've got agreements with Evergreen and Timberline that it's they call them auto aid, but both departments respond. We've been divvying up addresses. If we're faster to get to it than they are, we'll take it. And if they're faster than we are, they'll take it. We give it to them. All of this,
service first.
So
right?
it shouldn't matter. It shouldn't matter at the end of the day where you pay your taxes to. The level of service should be as close to the same as we could ever get it. And if we can continually look for improvement through agreements, that's we have an obligation for that. So those conversations happen as recently as even Saturday.
That saves everyone money and creates a more effective service, doesn't it?
It does. It reduces your overall cost of the operation to a certain degree. It's just we're I joke that we're all in this mess together, but we are. So we all need to work together to solve the problem, whatever that problem is. The presenter was a structured fire or just a simple medical assist on a visitor. And the sooner we all agree that we're all in this together, we're going to work together to do it, that's when we'll be successful.
Nice. Well, okay, Jeremy, let's got to get this in as soon as possible. I know we're going to talk about fire mitigation and efforts to reduce fire in the county, but you know, it's as bad as it's ever been right now since I've been here, and I think it's the drought situation and you know our extreme danger, but it's always existed here. And this is a little article from the Colorado Miner, just a little paragraph from the October 11th, 1879 issue. And it says that over on Chicago Creek, there's a forest fire raging. At the head of Fall River, a fire started the other morning, and immense dome-shaped column of dense smoke that rose from was the most magnificent sight ever witnessed, I guess, from the city, talking about Idaho Springs. For about 10 days, a roaring fire has been raging at the site of Fisk's Mill on the High Line Toll Road. We are glad to learn that the homestead, I should have brought my glasses, and ranch of Henry Myers, who has a nice little stock farm above Bakerville, is entirely safe from any forest fires that may now occur. Henry is an old pioneer, and when he saw the impending danger, he prudently commenced carefully burning around his place so that it no longer in danger. So that was early the fire mitigation efforts in Clear Creek County. And it continues to this day, except a little more organized, much more organized than that.
Yeah, I think it's a little more organized. I think thanks for bringing that article up. That article is perfect because we had major fires in 1875, correct?
1879.
So 20 years after mining started. So we were detimbering the county the entire time to support mining and construction.
Man.
So essentially mitigating, and we still had major fires.
Yeah, good
and
point.
Then we get to the 1935 to 1938 period. We quit mining in the community. Widespread mining stopped, and we have let all of that timber regrow.
Yeah,
pretty much unchecked to where we are currently today.
Yeah.
So we're in a worse position now than we were in 1879 without really understanding it, I think.
Yeah, that's a great point. And, you know, I think people don't have a clear understanding of just how much timber there is underground. When you're mining, not so much anymore, but in the old days, everything was braced with timber, and everything that went on underground required timber. Put it that way, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, and then you add pine beetles. Mm-hmm. I'm guessing pine beetles also happened in the 1800s, but we've sure got a serious problem with the wreckage they've left behind.
Mm. Yeah, I think we can talk about pine beetles. We've had two infestations, right? We had the late 90s, early 2000s, went through the lodgepole. We didn't get hit as bad as, say, Summit and Grand County. And now we're currently doing the exact same thing with a series of beetles that's in Douglas fir and the ponderosa pine, which historically has not seen beetles. And this goes back about 6-7 years, started in southern Colorado and is moving its way north. Now it's this year, the overfly will happen in July. I'm sure it'll show all the way into southern part of Wyoming, Medicine Bow.
That's a result of the drought.
And that's drought related, and we can talk about that. So when we stress trees out with drought, so pine beetles will bore into a tree, and a healthy tree that produces a reasonable amount of sap, a normal amount, will repel that attack with sap. They won't get in, and they go, oh, this, we don't want to work with this tree. We're going to try the next one. Well, we had drought, and sap requires water to be produced. So now we have drought and series of years of drought that were the tree's a little more stressed every year than it was the year before. Well, now when the beetles attack the tree, there's not sufficient sap to repel the attack. And once they get in the tree, then they put out a pheromone that tells all their friends, hey, this one's open for business.
Mm.
And they spread throughout the forest. So we've got a series of drought. We're 5 years, 6 years, and five, almost 6 years in this drought. And it's perfect conditions for the beetles. They're having a heyday. And then on top of that, we added a really warm winter. And it's going to be interesting to see how that affects it, because beetles have a finite amount of time they can endure cold through the winter before they run out of basic reserves and they die. We've had an incredibly warm winter, mm-hmm. so we're all kind of intrigued to see if we've got any carryover adults that survived the winter that shouldn't have, which is an anomaly, but it's possible. The science says it's possible. We don't have any proof it's happened. There's a lot of speculation. So that's being watched by the State Forest Service, too, to see how this warm winter is going to affect the life cycle of these insects, good or bad, and how this year turns out. So this is kind of a pivotal year to see maybe what our future looks like, because all the conditions have lined up in a negative way for us.
Right.
Yeah. It's extraordinary, the danger that I feel that is out there. I've got a go bag packed at my house.
And, good. And, I think everybody should. I think even if you live in the middle of town,
yeah,
like you're in the middle of downtown Idaho Springs in an apartment, you should have a go bag. I think it should just be what we do.
Yeah.
And hopefully more people are doing that.
And that's part of the training exercise that emergency management, I'm assuming you're participating in that too, that's happening over on the east side?
It is. So on May 2nd, for those that aren't aware of this, this is the first one we've ever done. It's an evacuation drill within the county.
Mm-hmm.
Focus on Highway 103. So it's Raven Ridge, which is right below the cell towers. That's Raven Ridge Road. There, Echo Hills, Beaver Brook, I'm drawing a blank on the other one. All those neighborhoods in that run on 103, we're going to evacuate them all, anybody that's willing to participate on May 2nd in the morning of. And all we're looking for is do the alerts work, yes or no? Do they have a go bag? How long did it take them to get out? And then we're looking at traffic issues.
Mm-hmm.
Where do we have restrictions and places that bottlenecks, and then how do we work with the county or look for solutions to get rid of those? So this is the first one we've ever done. It's us, Kirky Fire, Evergreen Fire, the Sheriff's Office, Jefferson County Sheriff's Office is also participating. So this is the cross-county thing we're talking about. We're all in this together. And we want to bring that over to this side of the county. So we're going to figure out what works and what doesn't work with this one, where we fail and where we succeed. And we want to do something similar for areas like Fall River, possibly Mill Creek. And so we're trying to use this as an idea to see if can we scale it up and down, and then what's involved with that. So,
and it looks like participation has been very active.
It sounds like it's exceptional. I was told in a meeting yesterday that South Metro tried to do a couple of these, and they had under 30 participants, and we're anticipating in the 100 to 150 range right now. That I know the numbers right now. I haven't seen the latest numbers. People continue to sign up to participate. So this is, I think the community understands the risk, and they're wanting to look for solutions and participate. So hopefully this is just the base of the pyramid that we're just going to keep improving our offering and how we operate.
Jeremy, I got to say that something that has occurred to me is that if we ever had a conflagration here in the county, which is becoming more and more, the potential is greater and greater, put it that way. I say to myself, there's only one road in and out of Clear Creek County. We have to have some kind of a call system that closes the highway so we can evacuate our citizens and people are just going to have to wait until we get cleared out. I don't know what that means, but I guess it's probably coordinating with CDOT and the State Patrol and whoever else has authority to close that highway.
It is. We had some conversations not 2 years ago now with CDOT's emergency management team and State Patrol, and that's exactly what will happen. If it's no different than evacuating Summit County, I think they've got more ways out than we do, so right. We talk to them. So they agreed that we have the ability to shut the highway down, basically at Morrison and Silverthorne. We've got to close the box.
Mm-hmm.
And once we do that, we can run traffic all going eastbound using all of the available lanes.
Right.
I think the Floyd Hill project, when it's completion, will hopefully improve our ability to do that. But that's the intent, and they agree that that's what we need to do. So we'll make some phone calls to the Traffic Operations Center, make the request. CSP does the same exact thing, and there's some coordination. There's a phone call group that goes out that coordinates that, and that's our intent, is to get people out of the county. At the same time, we're probably going to be bringing resources into the county,
mm-hmm.
but we're going to get pretty creative on how we bring additional resources in.
Mm-hmm.
From the Front Range, especially.
So who would have the authority to make that call? Would it be you or the sheriff?
I could request it, the sheriff, ultimately.
Uh-huh. Okay.
The sheriff is in charge of all the evacuations for wildland fire. Then, of mm-hmm. course, local police departments, of course, the chiefs of police are responsible in the municipal boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're in a position where everybody works together and that coordination exists. It's probably a 30-second phone call.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Say, hey, we're going live with it. It's not, what do you think? It's going to happen now,
uh-huh.
letting you know,
so
which
Mark,
is good.
Yeah. Mark, could you define conflagration?
That's an uncontrollable, raging, a huge fire.
So I immediately think of Glenwood Canyon mm-hmm. when I think of a conflagration.
That's a
and
tough word to
one
say.
got started uh-huh. and then rose up. Through up across the mountainside,
that's a small fire compared to what I'm talking about. If you think in terms of the fires that they've had in California and uh-huh. in Washington State, and Jeremy, I'm sure you've had these conversations. I know I have with friends of mine who deploy to those fires. And they say, imagine you're standing in Empire and you look up to the Continental Divide and you see flames crest the hill, and 10 minutes later you're engulfed. That's a conflagration.
Wow.
And that's what is potential, could potentially happen. Think about the today we're going to have winds gusting to 40 miles an hour. And if there were to be a heavy fire someplace in the community, it would just rage. Mm-hmm. There's nothing to stop it anymore.
Mm-hmm. No, and I think that's a good point. And Marshall Fire was a perfect example of that. It was structure-to-structure conflagration. East Troublesome. Fire essentially was spread in that direction. That's why it spread as fast as it did and then came over the divide. When we ran our drill with our CWPP, part of our CWPP revision process with the agency and the community, all the data shows that we can have a fire start at the west end of the community and come all the way to where we're sitting right now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
drainage to drainage, because all our drainages connect.
Mm-hmm.
Many are in wind alignment. So we've got a high risk of a fire starting at, say, Henderson 9 that ends up in our backyard relatively quickly if the conditions are right. Yeah.
Well, I know Joanne Sorensen have had conversations with you, Chief Jones, about all of the standing dead along I-70. And I was so happy to see the CDOT sign this week that said, truckers, anchor your chains, because those chains could send a spark into one of those trees. And I don't know if that's conflagration immediately, but it sure could lead to that.
It all starts somewhere. Which is a good segue to go into CDOT. So CDOT, I guess the advantage of having a light winter is they didn't spend all of their snow money.
Oh.
So CDOT is actively looking at right about $12 million reinvesting in mitigation.
Yay.
So we've been in conversations with their incident management team. Patrick Chavez leads that team, and it's exceptional. And we've submitted mapping that goes basically from Morrison all the way through the community of areas that we think are priority. So Berthet Pass, Highway 103, along the interstate. And with a higher concentration of areas, so like on I-70, when you get into the 219 above Bakerville, basically Bakerville to the tunnel, that's a high-risk area. So we asked them to concentrate some work up there because of the vehicle fire concentration we have up there. So we've provided them mapping. All the communities along the Front Range have done essentially the same thing. They provided some priority mapping. And now we're kind of waiting to see how that money gets allocated. But they have come to us and say, we have the funding. Where would you like us to do the work? Where should we start? Give us some top three priorities. And it's all, for us, it's all based off of evacuation routes and stopping roadside starts, keeping a roadside start on the roadway.
Well, so I'm so glad they came to you and had that conversation with you instead of maybe trying to figure out another use of that money. So that's terrific.
Jeremy, you've alluded to a number of your partners in the mitigation efforts. Maybe you could spend a few minutes talking about some of the coordinated efforts that are occurring. I know there's continuous planning and on-the-ground work done by numerous agencies. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So the big oversight, the overarching thing is the Kirkuk Watershed Forest Health Partnership, right? I think those that aren't aware of that. That's an organization now. It's eight now. It was nine. Arvada is no longer a voting member of that. But it's all the people that essentially use water that starts in our backyard and in this watershed. So that's Thornton and Westminster and Arvada and Golden. That's how it was formed. That's the overarching thing, and they have a very good director and basically a forester that is actively working within the watershed to develop projects. So that's the overarching project development. Then you get down to the ground level, and I think this is a conversation that should go beyond Kirkuk County. You've got us in Kirkuk County, along with Evergreen Fire Protection District that covers the 396 square miles of Kirkuk County. You have Timberline Fire Protection District that's right over the hill in Gilpin County. They've got the majority of Gilpin County. So all of us as agency partners are working to develop what we call cross-boundary projects, projects that don't care about the county line. How do we do the best work in the neighborhood, reduce the risk in the area? So York Gulch is probably our premier example, because the neighborhood stepped up and made amazing things happen over the last 5 years. And we're doing the same thing on the Evergreen side. So we're participating with them. We're adding chippers and doing some work on basically an Evergreen Fire Protection District portion of the county to support what's called a dumpster grant to reduce this neighborhood timber litter within a neighborhood. So you get down to that level, we're all working cross-boundary. And then on top of that, we've got an amazing forester that's for the state, Max, with the USFS, of course, is our district ranger, and he's phenomenal.
Good.
He is driving change at the lowest level all the way up to the management level of Forest Service to do projects. So that brings us into the Beaverbrook Watershed projects, which I think Mark is aware of because of open space. That's CPW land, that's state land trust, that's U.S. Forest Service, that's Kirkland County open space, and some private. That's the biggest mitigation project since the Blue Creek project above Empire that occurred in this community. Mm-hmm. That's all getting driven directly by the Forest Service and their management team. So we've got really good support across the board, and now it's kind of up to us as citizens to drive that change, to be willing to support these projects, to be willing to advocate for roadside mitigation or larger landscape scale projects that reduce the risk. So that's kind of my ask to people that listen is, be a champion for your neighborhood, be a champion for the county, and talk to your elected officials and say, we want to see mitigation. But that goes beyond that too. It's, we all have to fund it. We don't have the money to fund what we need to do. And let's be honest with that. We'd like to do $10 worth of work, and we've got $1.50 in our pocket as a community. So at some point, we as the as just residents of the community are going to have to be willing to fund the change. We can demand the change until we're blue in the face, but if there's no funding to support the demand, it's just it's us yelling in the room. So I just ask that people are willing to hear different ideas of how we creative ways to fund it, whether it's grant funding for the short term, which is kind of hit and miss, to a long-term solution for there's a funding stream that incrementally provides funding that reduces the risk over the next 50 years.
Do you have any thoughts on where that, how to that happen?
We're having some conversations about even a forest health district, which would include the downstream water users that rely on us to provide their water, and they would fund through a property tax or sales tax, or there's any variety of things, how that would be funded, that money gets spent in our community to reduce the risk, to make sure that they have water. Because I think at the end of the day, I think we forget the focus is, if we don't have a water source as a community, we don't have community. So it doesn't matter how much we love living here.
Yeah.
Once we lose our drinking water, whether it's Idaho Springs or Georgetown or Empire or Silver Plume, batten up the hatches, because we're closing down, right? We can't survive.
Jeremy, I just want to be clear for the listeners that what would be the motivation for Arvada, Golden, et cetera, to spend money in Clear Creek County, and it is this water quality issue, because if we don't have sufficient tree coverage and ground coverage to manage the flow of water into the creeks, that has it reduces the amount of water, and it substantially reduces the quality of the water going down. That's where their motivation would come from, and they have the money. We have the trees, you know.
Exactly. I think if you look at the Cameron Peak impacts on Greeley water, right, they're still experiencing impacts to this day from sedimentation flows that happen 50, 60 miles away from Greeley at the closest.
Wow.
So I think that's the conversation that we're having is we supply water. We're as the headwaters for the watershed, there's 450,000 homes or individual like accounts. That's not people. That's just I have a water account. There's 450,000 of those that rely on water coming from our backyard and remaining clean and be treatable to produce drinkable water for their communities
downstream.
And that also includes we have the same problem. So we would be the first to lose our ability to provide clean drinking water because we would receive the sedimentation first. Yep. We would have the worst of it, but it would affect all of us equally. And I think that's part of this conversation is we need to protect our water. And how we do that is keeping fire small, preventing post-fire effects. Things like the beaver restoration in Bakerville, right? That project alone is all about sedimentation and river quality and making sure that the water at post-event stays clean so we can all use it.
Go
the
beavers.
Beaver ponds?
Yeah, they're rehabbing that area by Bakerville. That's a huge project, and all driven by the watershed and Aqua and some other great partners. And all of this is around, if we have a fire event, how do we maintain drinking water post-event? And it's multifaceted. It's been really interesting to be involved in that, going back to 21 and some of those planning for these things.
To be clear, Lori, up in your gulch, you mostly exist on wells up there, I'm sure.
We do.
But in the municipalities, the primary source of water is surface water. Mm-hmm. Empire has an augmentation well, and I'm not familiar anymore with the other municipalities. But that is a limited supply, and it's all about the surface water. Mm-hmm. So a big fire is a major impact for our community. Well, this has been a difficult conversation to have. Let's take a quick break, and when we come back, Jeremy, I want to ask you a little bit about the fire authority itself, and maybe you can give us a status report, okay? Hillary Hahn, yeah, she's a fiddler. Okay, this is What's Upstream, and I'm one of your hosts, Mark Cuccinella, along with Lori Beckel, and we have Chief Jeremy Jones here with us today. This is KYGT LPFM 102.7, 103.9 on your FM dial. Stream us over clearcreekradio.com. All right.
One real quick PSA. This Saturday at Citizens Park, 11 a.m., the Clear Creek Dems will be sponsoring our monthly, really, it's an anti-Trump administration rally and protest. People come for a variety of reasons. What they find is that it's empowering to get together and have a place to share their concerns about what's happening in our country. So Citizens Park, 11 a.m. This coming Saturday. Anyone is welcome. We will appreciate seeing people there.
Thank you, Lori. And Chief Jones, we've been talking about fire mitigation and the extreme fire danger that we're facing. But the basis for our response to mitigation and risk reduction is our fire department, and which you command and take responsibility for their actions. Tell us some, the state of the fire department.
Well, I think we're kind of in a unique place right now. We've never been here, so we added. So this staffing wise, let's cover that. This is kind of a cool thing. We're currently staffing a station in Idaho Springs with a minimum of two, average of four. This is also this is volunteer and career together, working together. We've got two career full-time people that staff Georgetown 24/7. We've got two additional volunteers that'll staff out of Station 1 in Dumont, and which we've been really working incrementally to get to this stage. And on top of that, we made a shift. We've got a shift captain, which is essentially a battalion chief for any metro area department. That's the equivalent to the position. Mm-hmm. And they're on 24/7, and they work out of the Dumont station. And that went live in November. And that's thanks to the people that were willing to support the ESD ballot initiative, and that gave us that last little bit of funding we needed to fill the third position. We had two last year. They're fully, so that's fully staffed. So if you do full staffing, average staffing is 9 people now, not counting chief officers or fire prevention or anybody else. This is daily average staffing. We try to get to 9. Which leads us into, we've had a rash of fires this year, which is really kind of an anomaly. We had a dry spell, which is great. It was great to have a dry spell. Apparently that came to an end this year. But part of this change from all volunteer to a combination department is, on top of that, we've changed how we fight fire. Mm. We change how our tactics have changed to meet the standards of change and the science of change, and we've applied that. So, and we're seeing good effect. It doesn't say we're going to save every structure, because I'll never make that guarantee, because that's not the reality. The unfortunate loss in Silver Plume was just that. It was an unfortunate loss, that a series of events stacked against everybody involved and nobody was hurt. And that's the bottom line to that one, is that's what we want. The recent fire in Idaho Springs on the apartments, the tactic change that we've implemented, now we're on 6 years of that, kept that fire really to the balcony and just barely inside the structure.
Wonderful.
I talked to the resident, and nobody was hurt, and the building is completely south.
What changed?
Our understanding, I think Mark came up in he volunteered for more years than I wish to ever admit that I was with him on, but he volunteered for years with us. We used to have this weird mentality that, well, we have to go interior. We can't apply water until we find the seat of the fire. All of these things were kind of a joke, that the fire service is 150 years of a tradition, a lot of times unimpeded by progress, which is true. Well, the science behind fire fighting has changed, that we know if we apply water immediately, we improve conditions. But when Mark and I started, we were told not to do that because it makes it worse for survivors. Well, that's not the case. The science proves it's not the case. So we apply water from the exterior of the house structure immediately before we go inside. Mm-hmm. So we control the fire. We reduce the volume of fire before we even go into the structure. We used to not do that.
Yeah, now I'm a little bit hurt about that because
personal, Mark.
I put myself in extreme danger many times.
I've spent a lot of time with Mark in structures going, why are we here? What did we do wrong today?
Yeah,
we've changed the tactics on this stuff, and I think we're seeing the results. Idle Springs Motel, same thing, change of tactics. Mm. We lost one unit there. And I'm not going to say, well, we guarantee that we're going to reduce your loss by 50%. I'm out here selling cars. But we are trying to embrace the science, understand it, be better educated. And I think firefighters today are better educated than they've ever been. And that's good. That results in better medical care, how they handle structure fires, how they handle a simple, like a vehicle extrication. They did vehicle extrication on a Tesla the other day. It took them 10 minutes to get the door off the Tesla.
Hmm.
So this is, their education pays off. The more time they spend training and understanding these systems, the more effective they are. Mm-hmm. And the end result is, it's providing quality. The goal is quality care to the end user, whoever that person may be, whether it's the citizen. So I think that's, as a department, we've embraced that.
Jeremy, thank you for that. And there's no replacing well-trained and personnel that are commanded effectively with a good strategy. There's no replacing that kind of effort. But in addition to that, particularly in the fire service, your equipment is so important. You know, the trucks have to be modern, and they have to, you know, the pumps have to flow at a consistent high rate, and and so they have to be replaced over time. The gear that the firefighters employ manually, the gear that they wear, that That stuff all needs to be kept up to date. So that requires a capital fund in a plan for replacement. And maybe that's a little deep in the weeds. I'm sorry if it sounds that way, but that stuff is interesting to me.
I don't think it's deep in the weeds at all. I think so. We've changed how we operate as far as our apparatus. I think those that realize that we've gone to smaller trucks for the majority of our responses. We run about 1,900 responses a year. And I remember, I think Mark does too, when it was 200 calls a year for Idaho Springs Fire was the worst year of our lives. How are we ever going to, you know, survive this? And now we run, you know, way over that per month. on a busy month, it averages out to 1,900 a year. So we run smaller trucks, but they require replacement. You can run about 150,000 road miles on that truck on top of pump time and stuff on it before you have to replace the chassis. So that's one of our biggest challenges from a funding perspective is, and I'll tell everybody this right now, is I appreciate everybody's willing to fund the ESD. It was amazing. It's the level of support. I can't thank people enough. But the reality of it is the budget that I'm operating off this year is still $532,000 underfunded.
Mm. That's not sustainable.
It's not. It's not sustainable. And I think by 2030, we're going to be in a totally different same conversation we were almost at this year if it didn't pass. So we need to look at a long-term funding strategy for the community, and I think that's a hard pill to swallow for people. But I think we've survived very well going back. We've had volunteer fire in the community since about 1860, and we've survived with that. And I think that ship sailed several years ago, and we were a little bit behind the curve to catch up to the fact that our call load is higher than it's ever been. The severity of calls continues to increase. The risk in the community increases. We talk about roadside, a vehicle fire on side of the road could be a catastrophic event for our community if not handled properly. And that's where long-term investment in the fire authority really becomes a conversation. We're planning to continue that conversation with the municipal partners starting probably in June of this year in the community is, we collectively need to decide what we're going to do long-term for funding. And Mark's right, with gear, a piece of equipment is good for 10 years if we don't damage it. So our PPE is good for 10 years and we're supposed to replace it. Our air packs are similar to that. We can run longer than 10 years. And we figured out some good ways to extend the life within the rules with some different inspection. We get them inspected every year. All of this costs money, and I think that's and we're all facing the same kind of deficit, whether it's Evergreen Fire or it's us or Timberline. We're having conversations with Timberline about doing some joint grant applications for capital replacement across the two counties. I think that's where we need to be.
Well, Jeremy, without getting too deep in the weeds, but let's go one step further.
Yeah.
The funding is all based on mill levies. The municipalities don't pay an actual mill levy. They pay a mill levy equivalent. I believe that's true. And then the county residents pay a mill levy. And what is the mill levy in the county and the equivalent number for the municipalities? Is it around 9 mills? Did I hear that?
Yeah, for fire it's 9. So the total mill for the ESD is like 11.45. And part of that, so 9 of that 11 mills goes to the fire authority and the other 2.45 goes to help fund EMS.
Mm-hmm.
For those that don't know, EMS did start out as an ESD organization years ago, and then they got away from it. Now they're back to the ESD, unincorporated part of the county, helps fund EMS. So we get 9 mills of that to my organization, and then the municipal partners. So that, Silver Plume is the only one that actually has a mill on their taxes. So the residents of Silver Plume pay a mill. They pay 9 mills. But Empire and Georgetown and Idaho Springs pay an equivalent. So they can, it's up to them how they pay it. It could be property tax, it could be sales tax, and property tax in our towns is incredibly low. I think Idaho Springs is about $289,000 a year is what they get from property tax, just to put it in perspective for people. And so they pay the equivalent. So that's what we talk about is our funding is heavily dependent on a solid tax base, which, and if we have a catastrophic fire that takes out the tax base, it takes us out along with everybody else.
Yeah.
And I think that's where we're concerned.
I want to take this one step further, and then I'll let this be. So we pay as a community. Everybody pays a little bit differently, but about 9 mils. That's what it comes out to. What statewide, I know that number is much higher than 9 mils for the typical department. So let's say West Metro Fire, for instance, or South Metro or North Metro Fire, any of those big departments, the people who live within those districts, they don't pay 9 mils, do they?
No, they pay in the 14 to 18 mils. And I think where we have to put this in perspective, we do a mil for mil equivalent, right? So for us, on a great year, we get a little under $3 million if all the stars line up for budget with our mills. That same mill in Evergreen Fire Protection District becomes a $7.5 million mill equivalent because they have higher property value. As we get greater density, we have homes that are worth three times, sometimes three and four times what, say, my home is worth in town.
Mm-hmm.
All of that goes into it, and that's where it gets confusing, I think, because you talk to people, well, I pay 15 mils for, if like North Metro, for example, I pay 15 mils. Well, 15 mils in North Metro is probably reasonably sufficient because of the sheer volume of their property values. Mm-hmm. We don't, and that's our deficit, we don't have a huge property value, especially on this side of the county.
Mm-hmm.
The Evergreen side of the county is fortunate because they have a very high home value.
Mm-hmm.
We, those of us that live on this side of the hill, no, we don't have a very high home value. We've got larger areas. We've got areas of basically social inequality where they're lower income. Some of the trailer, we have the trailer parks.
350 mobile home residents.
Exactly. That fall into that index, the SVI index, and rightfully so. So how do we fund this beyond asking those individual households? It wouldn't even be them. A lot of them are renters. So we're asking the property owner to pay more taxes that we know long-term gets passed on to that individual renter that may be struggling just to survive today.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this is where we have to get creative on how we fund things. And I think what we've been talking about a little bit is now that we've got the unincorporated part funding increase, maybe we concentrate a lot of our funding sources in the municipal boundaries, which is where the majority of our call load is. Our call demand is within the confines of the city limits of the towns. And we have been fortunate in towns to never pay a fire tax mill in our history,
mm-hmm.
With the exception of Silver Plume. So I think this is going to be an interesting conversation. And I live in Idaho Springs, and it wouldn't probably faze me to spend $100 a year towards fire protection because we've never done it. And I think that's where the conversation happens as far as how do we creatively fund fire protection. Number one, we know what level of service do people expect and want. We have a pretty good idea of that. Well, then how do we fund it? How do we get there?
Mm-hmm.
And then how do we maintain that so it's not a one-off deal? It's long-term sustainable risk reduction,
mm-hmm.
so that when I'm retired and Mark's retired and we're complaining over coffee about how the world isn't working right, the fire protection system is still in place and functioning.
Jeremy, this is such a difficult conversation to have because people will say, well, Idaho Springs pays an equivalent amount as the people who live in unincorporated county. But that comes from sales tax, and the sales tax is 95% paid by visitors to your community. So it's kind of a free ride. I don't want to call I shouldn't categorize it like that. That's not fair either. But there isn't a proportionate tax burden, if you want to look at it that way, to the individual homeowners in the municipalities, myself included.
I agree. I'm sitting in the same boat as you. I live in town. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we that live in the community, as far as in the towns, probably should have a bigger part of the solution. I think we should pay, you know, more. We've been very fortunate. We've got healthy downtown districts in Idaho Springs. That historically wasn't the case for several years, and Georgetown used to have the exact opposite. Now Georgetown was maybe struggling a little bit this year,
mm-hmm.
And everybody's struggling across the board because of lack of snow and, you know, low visitation because of lack of skiing.
We're not going to have the rafters this year either.
That's going to be another impact. So I think all of us, I think that's where this conversation is incredibly difficult to have, but we need to have it, and we need as a community to figure out what level of service we want and how are we willing to make it happen.
Mm-hmm.
And we've never fully had that conversation in the community. We've had bits and pieces of it, mm-hmm. over the years, but I don't think we've ever really ripped the Band-Aid off, and I kind of joke, we might get beat up in the parking lot, but at the end of after the fight in the parking lot, we can probably figure out where we want to go, mm-hmm. and how we want to get there. So let's have the fight and figure out where as a community we want to be, and how we as a community, this is a community, how we're all going to get there together.
Right, yeah. And that's so personal responsibility includes understanding the financial situation supporting the kind of service we want with our taxes. But the other thing that you've really inspired in the community I live in York Gulch, is the partnership the residents and the HOA has had with the fire department, the fire authority, and how you have taught our community to be fire-wise. And I'm just wondering, are there services you'd like to mention that are available to community members to make each of us individually able to be more responsible?
Yeah, thanks for segueing into that, because that's important. Your community has been amazing, because we started out providing a chipper in the community, which worked, until we realized that the volume of material being produced was three times what the chipper could handle. So we switched in 2025. We switched to, you build the piles, we'll chip them, and that was remarkable. Probably made a mistake when I did that, because I underestimated the sheer amount of volume they could produce in a summer.
You don't know until it happens.
No idea. totally impressed. So we've shifted that model, and we're trying to do the same thing. We've done it up on Floyd Hill. Same thing. Build the piles, we'll chip them. We did a bunch of that in 2025. And we want to continue to do that. We are going to put a small 6-inch chipper, similar to what we did in York Gulch, up in St. Mary's this year. I have to finish servicing and get ready for the season. We're going to see if we can do the same thing in the St. Mary's community, because if they're already, they've stepped up and they want to make a positive change in the community, we want to support it. So we'll put a chipper up there and see how it works.
Mm-hmm.
And it's either going to be the most amazing thing, or we'll have to revamp it. But they want to try it, and we're going to support it. So we're doing that across the board, and we're working with Evergreen the same way to support. We've chipped in Widder Gulch, which is not in my district, but we wanted to tie in a Steiner Mountain Road to an Evergreen project. We said, you build the piles, we'll chip them, and we'll tie all this stuff into a project. And that's where we're trying to break down those boundaries and getting rid of the, well, this is my line, you crossed it. I think that's going away for all of the agencies in the community.
Mm-hmm.
We help each other out, and that's what we should be doing. And so I think a lot of it is helping homeowners reduce risk. And we're trying to work with the county to figure out a solution to slash management. I know that's a huge burden on the road and bridge, well, the transfer station, to process the volume that we can produce. So we're trying to figure that out, how we collaborate with them to, whether it's staffing, provide individuals to help with that chipping, to process that,
yeah.
Or what. We've offered that a couple of times. We're trying to work through that. So we know there's a lot of work to be done. It's just a matter of how can we all step up and do it. But I think it's an opportunity for us. I ask neighbors to help neighbors. Like, if you've never talked to your neighbor, maybe have a conversation with your neighbor. What we found in York Gulch, is, I think Lori can attest to it, is – I think there are a lot of people that historically wouldn't have talked to their neighbor that are now coordinating with their neighbor to chip each other's piles. It's really cool. Mm-hmm. And we're seeing that on Floyd Hill, where five or six homes are like, hey, the piles are ready, and we've got them all ready, and they all helped each other do piles. We didn't mm-hmm. see that 5 years ago. So we're seeing a change, mm-hmm. and I just want to support that in any way I can. And
nice.
That's my goal as an organization, mm-hmm. and I think we're fairly effective at that. We're trying to add capacity within the mitigation crew to do more property assessments, more home hardening assessments. That's really where we're pushing. And the crews will be out doing that this year. So they're not sitting in the station watching YouTube videos. They're going to be in your yard talking about which trees to cut. Mm-hmm. They're going to be in businesses doing business inspections and working with property owners to make sure their business survives a fire event.
Yeah. And being aware that we're currently in a stage one fire ban right now, is that correct?
Earliest I've ever requested a fire ban was this year.
Amazing.
By 19 days, to be exact, from 2022 was the 21st of April, and this year we were the second.
So well, how important that is for us all to know, so that if we see an illegal fire, we report it, or we, in a friendly manner, approach people and remind them we're in a fire ban, and to please put their campfire out.
We have just a few minutes left, Jeremy. Are there any other suggestions, recommendations that you can make to homeowners or renters, people living in Clear Creek County, as how to make themselves safe and make the property safe as we continue in this extreme fire danger?
I guess the one thing is get on the clearcreekfire.com and go to the library. And it's called the Colorado Guide. It's the Ready, Set, Go Guide. It's where you build your plan for your house. It has recommendations for how you mitigate your home. That's start there. If you don't want to download it online, those will be available at the library. We have to deliver them this week or next week, a stack for so the Idle Springs Library will have those available, and we'll probably get them out to Georgetown Library. Which also includes go grab a blue go bag that has a checklist on the outside that you put your documents in. Mm-hmm. All of this is important to be able to be willing and ready to evacuate if you have to, and then incrementally work around your home to reduce the risk. I don't think anybody has the money to do it all in one shot. There is a tax incentive to doing mitigation work for those. If you pay for a tree company to cut trees, make sure you take full advantage of the $2,500 tax credit the state of Colorado provides you for that expenditure.
Oh, that's a big one.
Don't miss a tax credit. There's not a lot out there, but there are a few things, and I think that's especially with the wind event we had this year. We're seeing hundreds and hundreds of trees blown over in the community.
Yeah.
And contractors are doing an amazing job to try to get those cleared as quickly as they can, but. If you spend money on mitigation, make sure you seek out the tax benefit to get that money back.
What's your recommendation for a clear space around a house?
The big focus is that 0 to 5, 5 feet off the home. Mm-hmm. If you've got a juniper tree, which everybody seems to have, right next to your house, I ask that you cut it down, and we will happily come chip it up into little pieces for you, because that's juniper is kind of the equivalent. We ask people, would you put a 5-gallon pail of gasoline in your living room? And they said, no, you're crazy.
Yeah.
But you put one outside your bedroom window.
Mm-hmm.
And that juniper tree.
And during drought conditions, that's the equivalent. So work that 0 to 5. Clean your gutters. If you're elderly, we'll clean your gutters for you.
Okay, Jeremy, I could personally go on for hours, and I know this is a big subject for my co-host, Lori, as well. And it should be, fire danger should be front and center in everyone's minds as we keep our families safe going forward this summer. So thank you for coming in. We'll have you in again on a regular basis, I hope, as long as I know you're willing. So,
well, always.
Okay.
So, Mark, let me just mention that next week on our show, we will have our new superintendent, who is just finishing his first year, Wes Pell. Paxton, and Jessica North will be on. She is the president of the school board.
Looking
so all
forward
things
to that.
Clear Creek Schools next week.
Yeah, we're all going back to school next week. See you then. Bye.